Thanks to our sponsor, Malloy Law Offices. They are a personal injury law firm here in the local DC area that helps others recover from car accidents, work injuries, slip and fall injuries, and other types of accidents. They work on what's called a contingency fee basis. So if you hire Malloy Law Offices after an accident, then you never pay anything out of pocket. They also offer educational content and free consultations for those who have more questions than answers, like us at DC by Foot. We're really excited to partner with them next month to learn all about personal liability as a tour guide in Washington, D.C. Visit their website at malloy-law.com or call their offices at 202-335-6141. Malloy Law Offices is open 24/7, so don't hesitate to get the right legal help you need after a personal injury accident.
Podcast land. Welcome to April. Welcome to Tour Guide Tell All. Welcome back. We are your friendly neighborhood DC based tour guides talking about history, scandal, spice, all kinds of fun things, American history, sometimes international history, very fun things related. We are back with you in your ear holes for another exciting episode. It's April. We're in the midst of spring. It's lovely out. And before we get into our topic for the day, a couple of things to mention. First of all, we are in the midst of spring tours. We are giving them. We're all over the place. It is busy. We are happening. It's good times. So come on a tour with us if you're going to be in the DC area. Second, patrons, thank you for being a patron. You are the wind beneath our wings. You are getting extra patron episodes, one a month, to thank you for being awesome. So if you want to get in on the ground floor on those, we're doing some fun stuff for the spring with our patron episodes. And as always, I'm Rebecca.
I'm Becca.
And together we are
the Rebeccas.
And we're back, fam. We are going to do an election episode.
We love talking about elections. In the past and in the present. And it's so fun to me because just about everything that's ever happened in American politics has happened more than once. There are almost nothing new under the sun when it comes to politics and elections. So we're going to dig into a pretty big election. As you probably know, it is a presidential election year in the United States. 2024 is an election year. And so we thought we'd take it back a little bit to a pretty fun to talk about election, the election of 1948.
Yes.
1948, please, we're going to apologize in advance if we say 1848. We just talk about the 1800s a lot. So,
yeah, but we really do mean 1948.
So
that's where we're at.
So this is a very fun election. If you listen to our podcast episode on Harry Truman, my birthday twin, you may already have a little taste of this already. That would make an excellent companion to this episode as well if you've not given it a listen. But 1948, for a little bit of context, Harry S. Truman is president of the United States. Franklin D. Roosevelt had died in office in spring of 1945, just before the end of the Second World War. Truman, as his vice president for just a short few months, had ascended to the presidency. So he has served for a majority of what would have been Roosevelt's fourth term. Now, 1946 were the midterm elections. Those are the big congressional elections midway through a presidential term. So Truman, while only being in office for not even 2 years, faces this big midterm election. And those post-World War II midterms were rough for the Democratic Party. The Republican Party flipped the House and Senate for the first time in almost 20 years. So the war is over, baby. This idea that we're all one country and we're all united. By 1946, partisan factions have settled back in very strongly. And so Truman is now facing a very combative and hostile Congress that is not really all that interested in bipartisanship. So the war days of, you know, brotherhood are gone. Truman's own party is not really thrilled. Nobody wants to lose midterm elections. No one wants to lose control of Congress. And there are Democratic Party leaders who think Truman is kind of dragging down the party when it comes to the down ballot races. And it's worth mentioning, you know, Truman was on the vice presidential candidate in 1944, but that was a wartime election. There wasn't a lot of campaigning. People were voting for the top of the ticket. They're voting for FDR. not a lot of Americans really knew Truman when he was running for vice president. And I use running very casually.
And he also was the compromise candidate. He was not FDR's first choice. He was not anybody's first choice. He's a, you know, he was a senator before he was vice president from Missouri, but he wasn't especially well known. And Truman is, Becca and I are, I think, on the record as being big fans of Harry Truman, especially Becca, because they share a birthday. And I think Truman's a much better politician than he gets credit for. And this, I think this election is part of why I think that. Truman, he steps into really almost an impossible moment in history. The war is ending on both sides, hopefully. They don't know that it's going to end on the Pacific quite as quickly as it does at that point when he becomes president, but it does. And then he has to figure out the post-war world. We have rising tensions with communist Russia, and they're solidifying in Eastern Europe. And his old Democratic, the Democratic Party coalition is falling apart. The three things that held the Democrats together through the bulk of the 30s and 40s no longer exist. First of all, the war is over. Second of all, the Depression is over. And third of all, Franklin Delano Roosevelt is dead. So those are the three things that had held Democrats together. And in the wake of this, they're fracturing. And Truman's going to, I think, bear a lot of that brunt. He also is suffering from a little bit of Democratic fatigue, right? Like, we tend not to like to elect the same party over and over again. And here Truman is as the fourth Democratic administration in a row. And I think people are getting a little like antsy about it.
A little antsy. And he's not really been battle tested in a real campaign for the presidency. Because when they were running in 44, it was at war. It was a very subdued election. Nobody was really traveling and campaigning. It was very different. So in 1946, he kind of takes this battering with the midterms, which often are seen as kind of a referendum on who's president at the time. And in 1946 public opinion poll, only 35% of those surveyed thought Truman was doing a good job in handling the presidency well. Those are low numbers, 35%. Add to that, that there is a huge wave of labor strikes happening in part in response to wartime wage freezes. So now labor unions are saying, hey, the war is over. Our workers need to get paid. There's rampant inflation after the war. The war economy had really been what was kind of holding everything in check, with that war economy done, these government contracts ending for a lot of manufacturing. Inflation is really high. And of course, when people aren't happy with the economy, they're not happy with the president. Labor had been such a stalwart supporter of the Democratic Party, but now there's a lot of labor upheaval. And Truman, as you say, I think we should give him some credit. He's a good politician in that he knows he's in trouble, and he knows he's in trouble in 46. He's going to run in 48. And he spends the next 2 years trying to make some moves to build up some support. He vetoes the Taft-Hartley bill, which is a big win for labor. He comes out more and more aggressively in favor of civil rights, which is an issue facing the entire country, certainly, but within the Democratic Party, this is an issue that's going to lead to some fracturing. Truman is very focused in the lead up to 48 in courting the Black vote, which is great. He's going to need them. But the more he comes out in favor for civil rights, the more it puts him in trouble with white politicians in the Deep South. We've talked about these sort of white Southern Democratic governors in particular. Truman's going to find himself coming to kind of blows with them. He is going to, I think, do something that's admirable, and that's not run away from FDR. You were talking about fatigue. I think that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. But instead of saying, I'm not FDR, and, you know, the New Deal was a bad idea, he really embraces New Dealism. He figures, you know, people voted for Roosevelt four times. They liked a lot of what he was doing. So Truman comes out in favor of nationalized health care. He comes out in favor of raising the minimum wage. He comes out in favor of federal housing programs. He starts really presenting himself as wanting to be a continuation of the things that FDR had, in the eyes of the country, done right, which was, you know, a focus on building America. Truman also tries really hard to have that strong anti-Soviet rhetoric as well, which we talk about that. That's a huge factor in this upcoming election.
I also think Truman ties himself to FDR really closely, which does help him, but I also think it hurts him in a certain way too. FDR and Truman are very different politicians. They look different, you know? And now FDR, like by tying yourself to the martyred FDR, like he's our fallen leader, that's a great strategy in continuing a lot of those successful programs. But Truman is, and this is a quote from somebody at the time, like FDR looks patrician. He comes from a wealthy background. He looks the part of like the president of the United States. And Truman looks like, and this is a quote, a shopkeeper. Like he's undistinguished looking. And he doesn't, right? He doesn't look the part of like the great man. And I think that that kind of hinders him a little too. It's very easy to underestimate Harry Truman. And this is going to, spoiler alert, be a problem for almost everybody except Truman in this election.
So you can see, I mean, people are underestimating, and people sort of, I think the popular way in which we talk about the election of 48 is that Truman's really on the ropes going into this, but he actually very strategically in between the midterms and the presidential is making moves, including really making sure people know he's strongly anti-Soviet, really speaking a big game as it is on the Soviet Union. And in May of 1948, when the new state of Israel is founded, he is going to, within minutes, formally recognize them and put the support of the United States, which is a very politically savvy move at the time, kind of making sure that he, as a Democratic president, is stepping right out. Now, there are definitely people interested in not seeing Truman win the 1948 election, obviously people outside of his party, but even some Democrats and liberals think Truman's not the right candidate. And there's a pretty influential group at the time, the Americans for Democratic Action. This is a liberal left-leaning group. And they try very, very hard to recruit a man, Dwight D. Eisenhower, to run for president, which makes a lot of sense. Eisenhower is the supreme commander of the Allied forces. He's the hero of World War II. And like, there are people going, why are we running Truman, the shopkeeper guy? We could be running General Ike, right?
He's our most popular living American. He won the war.
Who could beat him? It would be impossible. And indeed, spoiler, it would be later on. But at the time in 1948, Eisenhower claims to have no interest in politics. Which, if you know your American history, he has enough interest to later go on and be a two-term president. But in 48, for whatever his personal reasons, he refuses to let himself be drafted into this election. I also, as a little bit of context, want to just make note of the 22nd Amendment. You were talking about FDR fatigue. When it comes to fatigue, the people most fatigued by FDR winning four terms are the Republican Party, because they didn't really love the idea that one president, particularly from the opposite party, could be president indefinitely. And so many Republicans in 1946, in these midterm elections, had run on the idea that there needed to be tenure for the president. So many of these representatives and senators who flipped the House and Senate, they had really run, these candidates had run very anti-FDR and very much like, we got to put a limit on it. So this was a priority issue for this Congress. Trust me, this Congress accomplishes not a lot between 46 and 48, but they sure as heck get the 22nd Amendment through. And I think that it's important to note, this is fairly bipartisan. Even Democrats recognize that if the shoe were on the other foot, they wouldn't necessarily love one party in power a long time. So it's going to take some time for this to happen. They agree on language for the amendment 1947. It takes 3 years to ratify. So it's not ratified until 1951. But what it means in this 48 election cycle is that the conversation of a long tenure, conversation of FDR, Truman's kind of connection to FDR stays in the conversation during this campaign. And there is a grandfather clause in this amendment as they're working out the language that this would not apply to Harry Truman. It would not apply to him anyway. So it's irrelevant to this particular election. But I think it's just worth acknowledging that this is also a point where people are saying there has to be a limit to how long one person can be in power. And Truman is tied to that one person that has caused essentially the creation of this amendment. So we know that Truman, he's a Democrat, he's the incumbent, he's likely going to be the candidate for the Democratic Party. Let's turn our attention to the Republicans in 1948.
The Republican Party, they've been in the wilderness for a long, long time, and they're really very heartily sick of being in the wilderness, and they see at opening. Truman is weak. America is kind of done with the Democrats. They're ready. Their convention is held in Philadelphia in late June, and it only takes 3 ballots to put Thomas Dewey as the Republican candidate. Other major contenders are going to be Minnesota Governor Harold Stassen, former World War II General Douglas MacArthur, which, thank goodness, we went in a different direction on that one.
Woo! Whoa, dodged a little bullet there, I would say.
Yeah. Ohio Senator Robert Taft. Dewey was the governor of New York, and he had paved the way with his primary wins, but there's still enough sort of dissent around his nomination. There's enough other people sort of in the race to force a 3 ballot vote. And the Republicans have not voted beyond a first ballot since. So this is the last Republican convention that was really, that goes beyond one ballot. So they've coalesced around, or more accurately, they've done their fighting pre-convention and had coalesced around a candidate once they've started.
I think that's just worth noting. You know, today most of us tune into a convention knowing who the nominee is going to be generally because of the primary process and everything. But this is sort of 48's one of the last elections where there's a real dissent when it comes to balloting. Mm-hmm. There's been a few others and we've talked about them here or there, but we're kind of reaching a tipping point in American politics or with the two-party system where they no longer want these conventions to show dissension, right? They want to show unity.
Yes. The Republicans are going to endorse a very similar platform to what they had run on in the midterms in 1946. And it is worth noting that there is resistance in Southern delegations to Plank's supporting an end to a poll tax, anti-lynching laws, and federal civil rights legislation. So the Southern delegates will successfully protest and secure seats reserved for Southern voters on the panels with these issues. So they are going to effectively block the discussion of any anti-lynching laws and anti-poll tax laws, things like that. Civil rights debates, it is nowhere near as central to the Republican convention as it will be for the Democratic convention later. So spoiler on that, we're going to get to that later. Thomas Dewey.
Who is he? Who is this guy?
Who is Thomas Dewey? He's a mild-mannered kind of guy, this Thomas Dewey. He is highly effective and efficient, considered very honest and forthright. He's a good guy, this Thomas Dewey. This is not his first foray into presidential politics. In fact, he had run against Franklin Roosevelt in 1940.
He'd run in 1944 against Roosevelt. But he'd actually, in 1940, when he was only 38 years old, he actually was kind of the favored candidate of the Republican Party, and he won their first ballot. But then because he was 38, he was so young, he was considered maybe too young, too inexperienced. He had kind of this non-interventionist stance on global affairs, which by 1940 seems a little out of touch of what's going to inevitably happen with World War II, that he ultimately doesn't become the nominee, but he'd already been in the mix in 1940. And then when you get to 1944, he is like the leader of moderate Republicans and very easily becomes the Republican nominee. So you're right. He'd already had one go at the presidential race.
And I would just like to note for the record that if you're 38 in 1940, 8 years later, you're still only 46. And imagine a president who was only 46. I'm just going to throw that out there for us, everyone. By 44, he is a leader. He's a moderate. So he's bringing a diverse coalition. He wants to represent the moderate wing of the Republican Party, manages to easily take the nomination in 44. He's the first presidential candidate born in the 20th century.
Aw.
Isn't that nice? Yeah. He ran against FDR. He rails against inefficiencies and alleged corruption of the New Deal, but does not, in the midst of a war, he does not attack FDR as a wartime commander. He does not make any mention of commander-in-chief stuff, which I think probably it does not help his candidacy.
It was probably the most ethical and moral decision, but probably does not politically play out for him, ideally.
No. He does better than any other Republican who faces FDR in a general election. 45.9% of the popular vote, but is crushed in the Electoral College. And FDR very easily wins a fourth victory. And Dewey is not really interested in dismantling the New Deal. That's not his jam. He has a vision for pivoting New Deal programs to fit the Republican ideal, but he does not really want to get rid of it wholesale. And he is seen as a candidate that should appeal broadly to the nation. And he makes a sparkling pick for vice president, or the party makes for him. Really excellent. He picks Governor Earl Warren of California. Earl Warren is a handsome family man. He's from the West Coast. He's a successful Republican governor in California. This is a dual governor ticket, which is very rare today. We don't see two governors running together.
I think the last time was a Libertarian ticket a few elections ago, but like your major parties, nobody does dual governors. And it seems so smart in 48 to do this because they both are running two big, huge states, which means they certainly understand how to run the large nation.
Right. And so Warren he's very popular. This seems to be, you know, California cool, and he's reassuring. And he is, yes, that Earl Warren who will eventually go on to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. That doesn't happen for a little while, but two things. First of all, he's the same Earl Warren. And second of all, this is not the last time we're going to mention the Supreme Court in the next 10 minutes. So the Democratic Party, boom.
Yeah. So I think it's just worth noting, though, that Republicans have chosen a candidate really above reproach. There's nothing on the surface wrong with Thomas Dewey. And in fact, I mean, he really was a beloved governor. You know, this is a man who there's no corruptions. There's nothing to get upset about. This is the kind of guy who wins elections. I mean, truly.
I will say, however, historically, there's nothing wrong with Thomas Dewey. He is an upstanding and very good governor. He's a good guy. Americans don't tend to like a loser, though. He's already lost in the national stage once. We don't tend to love that or forgive it. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Very true. Very true. So the Democrats also have their convention in Philadelphia. They meet July 12th through 15th. It's not an accident that both conventions are in Philly that year. This was a city, one of just very few in the country, who had connected themselves to coaxial cable, which allowed for live gavel-to-gavel coverage all up and down the East Coast. So there's been this big technological boom. Philly is a city that has used coaxial cable to connect itself all over. And that means that these conventions could have real TV coverage in a way that did not exist before. Now, there were only three networks at the time, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And of those three, NBC and CBS have the technology to actually do live broadcasts. So this is the first time in America's history that you had a broadcast live of the entire convention. Sadly, much of that film has been destroyed or is in terrible condition. There's very, very little of the film of the live broadcast that survived today. So I'll link to one or two things in the show notes, but unfortunately, there is not much. But you can imagine people are starting to gather around TVs to follow this political news. Going into this convention, there's really no question for most people. Truman is president of the United States. Whether you love him or hate him, that's an advantage. The incumbency helps. It helps if you're the guy who can say, I've done this job and I know what it entails. But there is a lot of dissension in the party about the platform. And we've talked about this in other election episodes, but your convention isn't just about naming your nominee. It's about laying out what your party is for. What are the things your party wants to support? The planks of the platform, as it were. And civil rights is a big discussion in 1948. There is a lot of pro-civil rights Democrats, but there's one in particular, Hubert Humphrey, who at the time is mayor of Minnesota. And he is going to lead a fight to have this party plank centered on really substantial improvements for civil rights. And Humphrey says in a speech that the party needs to, quote, get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights. And again, this is 48. So think about what's going to happen over the next 20 years. Hubert Humphrey is very correct, right? The party needs to take a stand, and this is something we have to do. This plank passes, but just barely. We're talking 651 delegates to 582 delegates. Truman has been trying to walk a delicate tightrope on this issue. He has been trying to support civil rights in his rhetoric without having to tie himself to any particular policies until he can win re-election. And he agrees to accept this plank. He figures, you know, if I come out in support of this plank, it's won the convention. Everybody's going to come together for party unity. But that is not what's going to happen.
No.
Because you've got places like Mississippi and Alabama and South Carolina and all these other places where these delegates are hell-bent on doing whatever they can to stop any progress on the issue of civil rights. So before it is time to even vote for their nominee, all of Mississippi's delegation leaves, half of Alabama's delegation leaves, and most of the Southerners that stay, they stay simply to vote against Truman. So there's this moment when this plank passes and the party just starts to disintegrate. You're just bleeding out delegates from the South. And so Truman wins on the first ballot, but it's coming on the heels of this dissension and upheaval around civil rights.
And there's also the sense that Truman's like, he's the president, and so obviously he's going to be the nominee, but they're kind of meh on Truman. There's a real sense that we're doing this because we don't have another option, because we can't go against a sitting an incumbent president. And there was a popular song at the time that was, "I'm Just Wild About Harry." And at the convention, they say, well, they have pins that say, "I'm Just Mild About Harry." So he's not getting like a huge FDR level standing ovation as he accepts the nomination. He also is going to have some issues, and sort of, I think partly because of he's so unpopular, he has issues finding a vice president. The first person he wants to run with him is someone we have talked about on this podcast before. That would be William O. Douglas. William O. Douglas is a Supreme Court justice. We did a whole pod on him. Douglas turns him down reportedly because he says, "I don't want to be a number two man to a number two man."
That does sound exactly harsh. Like Douglas.
Does sound like Douglas, yeah. Harsh, though. It's harsh. I don't like it. So eventually, he's going to choose Senator Alvin Barkley of Kansas as his vice presidential nominee. Barkley is also the convention chair and has given a very rousing speech in support of Truman, gives a keynote, and he really propels himself to being the vice presidential frontrunner.
Yeah. So, you know, he chooses Barkley, is like himself, a Midwesterner, a good stalwart of the party, seen it through thick and thin. Barkley had really opened up the convention with this incredible speech. And so he kind of proves to himself that he can maybe drum up some enthusiasm where there maybe isn't a ton. But here's the thing about Truman. He knows that this has not gone great, that people are not feeling roused. And so when it's time for his nominating speech, he gets up there. And Truman's fired up. You know, there's this sense that you have to, the South's walked out and people are making fun of him with their buttons. And, you know, he's had enough. And he gets up there and he says, "Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget it." And he gives this speech where he just says, "I'm going to go back to Washington. I'm going to call the Republican Congress back into session. I'm going to make them pass my legislative agenda. And they're going to have to stop being a do-nothing Congress." And that's exactly what he calls them, a do-nothing Congress. And here's the thing about Truman. He knows that they're not going to do that, but it puts them on the defensive, puts them on the back heel, and it basically lets him set up what's going to be his entire campaign strategy, Truman versus Congress.
So he's going to tell them, "I'm bringing them back to Washington, force them to do something." And what he does, this is so masterful. He doesn't run against Dewey. Exactly. I mean, he does, obviously, but he also runs against Congress, these bums who aren't doing anything for you. Look at all the things they could do, but are not doing. And in fact, I'm taking action by calling them back to do their constitutional duty in Washington so that they can pass things for the American people. It's a brilliant idea to sort of position him as the guy who gets it done. So smart.
This is not about Democrats versus Republicans. It's not about Truman versus Dewey. There's nothing that Truman can attack Dewey on. They have substantially no major differences. They have policy disputes, but they are both honest, forthright men. There's nothing they can really debate on. Truman's going to make it about Congress. And people left the convention feeling more enthusiastic about Truman than they felt like when he went in. Look, there are lessons to be taken from the election of 1948, in my humble opinion.
There's a historian just this morning who made that exact point. To that exact point.
I do think we should circle around to what happens to the Southerners that leave, because the Southern delegates that pack up their toys and go home don't exactly go home. They are not happy. They are very quite mad about being what they feel like is pushed out of the Democratic Party, not respected for their pro-states rights opinions. And in fact, they feel so strongly that they meet in Alabama. They bind together in Alabama a month later, and they form their own party. It's officially called the States Rights Party. You probably heard it referred to as Dixiecrats. So they're basically saying, we're the Democrats for Dixie, for old Dixie. This is very clear, you know, what they mean and what they want. These are the states that are not going to budge when it comes to civil rights. And naturally, they will nominate their own candidate, a guy you've maybe heard of if you were born before 2010, a guy named Strom Thurmond. Yep, that guy. Strom Thurmond lived to be like nearly 100, a longtime member of Congress, Strom Thurmond. He is going to be nominated by the States Rights Democratic Party, the Dixiecrat Party. He is at the time governor of South Carolina with all that entails. This is a man who has firmly been pushing his state's right to, you know, ignore any civil rights legislation that comes his way. And here's what's so insidious about what the Dixiecrats are trying to do. They know how the Electoral College works. They know it doesn't matter who they ran. No candidate of this party is going to win the general election. They know Strom Thurmond can't possibly win. Their strategy is to bleed votes away from Harry Truman and the Democrats just enough, ideally, that it goes to the House of Representatives. We've talked about this in past podcasts, but when you don't have enough Electoral College votes to meet that majority, then it goes into the House of Representatives. And they figure if they're the reason the election goes to the House, they're going to have the upper hand because they can then try to force some concessions from Truman or even from Dewey, if the case may be. But they know that both Truman and Dewey have Southern constituents and that they can force concessions. And frankly, even with a Republican-controlled House of Representatives, there are plenty of Southern Republicans who are sympathetic to caving on civil rights. And so their plan is, I mean, it's awful, it's dastardly, it's insidious, but it's also strategically very smart because this is a very likely scenario that could happen. And that's exactly what they set themselves up for. There is another candidate in the mix, a little guy named Henry Wallace. Here's the thing, Truman not only is losing support from the Deep South, he's losing support from his progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Truman is truly, similarly to Dewey, a moderate in his own party. Truman is not a far left progressive. Henry Wallace is a very progressive liberal. He had been FDR's third vice president. He had been Truman's secretary of commerce, but he feels that Truman is not handling foreign policy right. Wallace thinks that Truman is pushing close to what we might call later in a few years, McCarthyism, that there's too much focus and this rhetoric against the Soviet Union is hurtful here at home. We have to be more open and inclusive. And so Wallace is going to run as an independent candidate as part of the Progressive Party in an attempt to, again, bleed votes away from Truman. So Truman is going into this election with the Democratic Party splintered essentially into three. And it's not looking good for him from, if you're into an electoral map, strategically, this is not looking very good. But you're right. He has a plan, and that plan is to embarrass Congress.
It's so great. And it's easy to do. He brings Congress back to D.C. in late July and presents them with a list of things that he wants. Basically, I brought you back. And here's the thing about the summertime in Washington. We've talked about this before. Since the beginning of the Republic, Congress goes out of session at some point towards the end of July, beginning of August. They all go back to their home districts. They take a vacation and they also meet with their constituents. That's happened fairly regularly for at least in the modern era. Partly because no one actually wants to be in Washington in the summertime, especially, I would imagine, in 1948, when there's not quite as much air conditioning and, you know, whatnot. It's hot here. And so Truman is going to deliberately bring Congress back. Congress meets for 2 weeks, passes nothing. Nothing. And then adjourns. And so basically, Truman gets a few things. He gets to point at Congress and be like, I tried to get them to do something and they didn't do nothing. And he gets time on the campaign trail where he like basically constantly point to, I brought Congress back to Washington. They're not doing a thing. These are your representatives. They're not doing anything. It's brilliant.
You voted for these guys in 1946. I wanted to pass farm bills. I wanted to pass manufacturing bills. I wanted to pass labor bills. I wanted to pass civil rights bills, and they did nothing. So whoever he's talking to, he has a bill he asked Congress to consider, and they didn't. It is brilliant. And Congress does it. They give it to him on a silver platter, right? They don't even really try to pass anything. And that just gives him endless amounts of time to criticize Congress, which is really everybody's favorite thing to do.
It really is the nothing new under the sun. And one of the things I think that Truman benefits from, and I think we'll talk more about the farm vote in a minute, is Truman and his running mate are both from the middle of the country where there are a lot of farms. His two opponents are from the coasts. So this is not new. Like we talk about coastal elites today. This is not new. Truman kind of basically makes the point without making it that like, oh, you know, this guy from New York isn't going to care about agriculture. This guy from California isn't going to care about agriculture. So he's talking to farmers. He's talking about civil rights leaders. And in a lot of ways, the emergence of the Dixiecrats helps Truman because he's now free to, well, blessing in disguise, I think is how Becca puts it. He knows that they're not going to vote for him anyway. So he doesn't have to court them and can be free to take action on civil rights.
He doesn't have to walk that tightrope anymore. Once they leave the party, as it were, once they say, we're running our own guy, Truman gets to go, great, see ya. Now I can cater to our more moderate wing of the Democratic Party. That's okay with desegregating the military. That's okay with ending discrimination and federal civil service jobs. So he does that. He issues two major executive orders in this time period leading up to the campaign, desegregating the U.S. military, huge, right? That's so significant. Saying that you can no longer discriminate in federal civil service jobs. Yeah. That's huge. And those are big wins. And you know what? Is it going to lose him votes in Alabama? Sure. But they were never going to vote for him anyway. And so Truman, it really is. I think it like gets to take the shackles off a little bit for civil rights. And he kind of just goes, look, I know that I can point to these men who served and say, you say, look at these guys. They've served their country. We need to desegregate the military. He doesn't have to worry about all this like dog whistling and tiptoeing. And I think in the long run, the Dixiecrats splitting off works better for Truman than not, because he would have spent the whole election trying to watch everything he said in regard to civil rights. And instead, he can just openly court Black voters, which turns out to be very smart. And I should say back then, man, campaigns were just very different. He doesn't even officially launch his reelection campaign until Labor Day weekend. So, you know, two months of campaigning.
Imagine what that would be like.
If only that was the world. But also Labor Day, hello, that's not accidental.
Yep.
He kicks off with a massive labor rally. He knows the labor unions have been upset. He knows it's been tough coming back from the post-war economy. And he is going to take some time to really pay attention to labor, listen to labor, make them feel heard, remind Americans that it's these labor unions that are the core of America and of American manufacturing and work. And he does that by making them the center of his kickoff campaign. And then Truman, like when I say campaign, I mean the man travels around the entire country by train.
Masterful. He gives this retail campaign. He goes whistle stop. Gives informal interviews. He talks to local newspapers, local civic associations. He meets with all kinds of people and grinds it out. And at 64 years old, Truman is not a young man. And he's putting in from Labor Day until Election Day to about 2 months. He is up at dawn, 16-hour days. He has up to 10 appearances in a day. He's meeting all over the place with really anybody who will meet with him. He travels for 15 solid days at one point, over 8,300 miles from Pennsylvania to California. Like he's going all over the country and meeting with all kinds of people. And he really understands, and this I'm going to contrast this with Dewey in a second, but he really understands the idea of retail politics, about meeting people kind of where they are, shaking hands, and this whole like folksy Truman thing. He's got this Midwestern vibe that like works for him in a big way. And Dewey does not do that. Dewey does half the appearances. He gets up, his first appearance is at 10 a.m. He appears unhurried, unbothered, not unmotivated exactly. He doesn't have that like extra push. Dewey seems to view this as a foregone conclusion.
Or an obligation, right?
Right.
You have to get up and give some speeches in order to get to the presidency. Whereas Truman is fighting for his job and his life, and he lets that show. It's the give him hell, Harry. I mean, that's what it gets dubbed, right? But he has nothing to lose. I mean, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? They're going to vote him out.
Yeah.
So at this point, he's willing to call out the do nothing Congress. He's willing to call out what the Republicans, you know, refuse to do. He gets real fiery in his speeches. They feel really passionate. He sweats and he, you know, he gets mad or, you know, he tells jokes and it's funny. And he's really, really savvy about tailoring what he's doing. So if he's talking to farmers, it's everything's about the farm. If he's talking to manufacturing, it's all about manufacturing and labor. Talking to mothers, it's about, you know, child welfare. He's really, really smart about knowing that you take your stump, but then you need to have 25 versions of it. Whereas Dewey often seems to be very rote. It's the same messages over and over. Whereas Harry in those 10 appearances might give 10 different speeches. And it, I think, is rooted, again, if you listen to our Truman podcast episode, Truman's a man who had a lot of jobs before he ever got into politics. And most of the success he found in his life was through relationships he made with people, serving in World War I, getting involved in kind of civic organizations. And I think he just understands at a base level that at the end of the day, a guy has to like you to want to go vote for you, or they have to feel like they know you.
Right. And you have to give people a reason to get up on the first Tuesday in November and go to the polls. Like, that's a important, and to not take anything for granted. And it very much seems like, particularly as the campaign winds down, he views this a little bit as a burden. It's a little onerous for him. He plays it very safe. Dewey had run into problems in his first presidential campaign, sort of attacking, coming out on strong positions. And so he avoids doing that in the 1948 campaign. He doesn't want to make pronouncements that he'll then have to go back on as president. And so he's going to he's vague on issues. He's kind of, you know, doesn't take a firm stance on a lot of things. And so Dewey's going to play it safe. He doesn't want to touch anything controversial or complicated. And everything is old that is new again in politics. There's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah. And I don't want to lay it all firmly at the feet of Thomas Dewey. This is the advice he's getting from very respected advisors, the Republican Party writ large. The mentality is Truman's never going to win this thing. His party's underwater. It's split in three. All Dewey needs to do is avoid a major embarrassment or a major mistake. And so the advice he keeps getting is calm, cool, collected. Don't say too much. Don't do too much. The less you say, the less likely you are to like trip up. And he's getting a lot of advice from other people of this as well. And that's something that I think later he'll come to sort of regret, is relying so much on these, you know, consultants and professionals who think that the only way to lose an election is by making a mistake or embarrassing yourself. One editorial later writes, quote, "No presidential candidate in the future will be so inept that four of his major speeches can be boiled down to four historic sentences. Agriculture is important. Our rivers are full of fish. You cannot have freedom without liberty. Our future lies ahead," end quote. Those four sentences are literally from four of Dewey's speeches. It's just platitudes, right? It lacks substance. It lacks passion or fervor. And he gives those same speeches over and over and over. And it just seems, it's easy to look back on and say, oh boy. But even at the time, some of these political writers are going, all right, well, we've heard this from Dewey for the fifth time. Like, what's kind of going on? And I think he underestimates Truman very much. And I think he doesn't quite recognize that Truman's not FDR. He felt like with FDR in 44, everything became very partisan. FDR had no trouble sort of getting into the heat and debating and kind of pushing back. And so Dewey was so hesitant to get into that with Truman that he just refuses to really even touch on Truman at all. And here's the thing. It's not just that Dewey's doing this because everyone's telling him to do it this way. He thinks what he's doing is working. And the reason he thinks that he's doing well is that's what the headlines mostly say. Truman's going to lose. Dewey seems to be the favorite. We went to so-and-so diner and, you know, these five guys say they're going to vote for Dewey. They're tired of Truman. It's that same thing over and over. And there are the polls. And here's what I will say about polling. Polling was still very new in the 1940s. It's something that emerges in the 20th century, but the way in which these polls are conducted, much like even polling today, polling data is very challenging to collect, right? How do you get to the people who are going to vote? How do you get a real cross-section of people? The polls in 48, though, overwhelmingly favor Dewey by many, many, many points. In fact, one polling firm, Elmo Ropert, announced in September of 48, so we're talking about a couple weeks into the election, they say they're going to stop polling entirely on the presidential race because the outcome seems so clear. So, you know, you're Dewey, you're the candidate. Somebody's giving you headlines that say you're going to win. Someone's giving you polling data that says you're going to win. You're not going to change your strategy. It seems like what you're doing is working well. And some newspapers even just pivot to covering Dewey as though he is the inevitable candidate. They start talking about the transition. They start talking about potential cabinet nominees. So, you know, that's what's going out into the newspapers. So Dewey, I think, is getting a sense, perhaps falsely, of security in how this election is going to play out. And the final pre-election Gallup poll is taken in mid-October. And it's made public one day before Election Day. It had Dewey 49.5% to Truman's 44.5%. So that's about a 5-point spread. Close, not exactly. You know, if you factor in a couple percentages for error, it's fairly close. But, you know, that's kind of where the polling's been. The polling's consistently had Dewey up 5, 6, 7 points. And there's a little political cartoon, I'll drop it in the show notes, that ran in October, just about a week and a half before the election. And it showed Truman and Dewey looking at this bulletin board with all these poll results and headlines. And there's this very dapper looking Dewey. And he remarks to a very bereft, sad, worn down looking Truman. And the little Dewey character says, "What's the use of going through with the election anyway?" So that's the messaging that's out there in the media. And we shouldn't discount the role the media plays in this particular election.
Yep, exactly. In fact, the Chicago Daily Tribune will print 150,000 copies of their post-election headline that Dewey defeats Truman. So they have called the election and printed a newspaper before the election even happens, which, yes, technology is considerably slower and different back then, but also that seems a little irresponsible. And on election night, Dewey is in New York at the Roosevelt Hotel. Truman is home in Missouri. He had snuck away to a hotel for dinner and a Turkish bath, and then he goes home and goes to sleep. Truman takes an early lead, but the assumption is that he cannot win. And so no one calls the race.
Yeah, none of the newspapers, none of the radio, you know, people are reporting live as they do now, right? As these returns are coming in. But even though Truman's up, nobody feels confident that that's how it's going to stay. And that's what Truman hears on the radio. I'm up, but I'm not going to win. I guess I'll go to sleep.
Right. Why stay up for it? Truman is woken up at midnight, or he wakes up at midnight and turns on the radio to hear the announcer say that he's up, but can't win. And so then goes back to sleep. At 4 a.m., a Secret Service agent wakes Truman up and he hears he's up by 2 million votes. He asks to be driven to Kansas City and tells the Secret Service agent, "Well, looks like we're in for another 4 years."
I just want to say, I love the way Truman acts on election night. You know, he had to go back to Missouri to vote because you vote where you live. He spends some time with his family. I love that little escape off for like a little spa night. Like, because what are you going to do? Whatever happens, happens at this point. And I love that he's just like, he's not tracking the returns. He doesn't have like a council of people around him. It's basically him, Secret Service, and a radio. And that's how he knows he's eventually that he's up by 2 million points. This is very, very different from how Dewey spends the evening.
Oh my goodness. I love this so much. Dewey knows he's in trouble based on the early returns for New England. So Dewey knows he's in trouble fairly early on in the evening. He's got the war council. He's got all the people and the lawyers and the pundits and the whole thing. Like, he has an apparatus, whereas Truman's like a couple of guys in a van with like a radio and some Secret Service protection. Like, he's chilling out. He stays up all night tracking the returns. And by 10:30, he knows that he has lost. He will send a gracious telegram to Truman conceding the election.
And I will say Dewey handles it, I think, very graciously. And, you know, and he knew what a lot of the, I think, pundits didn't, which was he saw as things were coming in early, that all these little places were just not swinging the way that he needed them to. And there's usually a domino effect to something like that, that if you didn't do so well in this state or this county, it's probably going to reflect somewhere else in the Midwest and somewhere else on the West Coast. And I do feel for Dewey in that regard, that he seems to be smarter than most of the political media of the time and knows pretty quickly that this did not go the way he wanted. And he does not put up a fight. He does not question or challenge in any way. And he is a real gentleman about it. So hats off to Thomas Dewey in that regard.
And the popular vote actually ends up the way that the polling had suggested, just in the opposite direction, right? Like, Truman wins 49.5%, Dewey wins 45.1%, and Strom Thurmond and Henry Wallace each take about 2.4% of the vote. However, because of our system, we have an electoral college, this is going to add up to an electoral college blowout. For Truman, a whopping 303, Dewey has 189. Strom Thurmond takes 39 electoral college votes from Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, and one vote from Tennessee. So he does get 39 electoral college votes.
And just take a moment to note those states: Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee. This is basically foreshadowing of the next 20 years. Name a state that doesn't want to take action on federal legislation regarding civil rights, and it's from one of those five states. Think of where federal troops have to be sent. Think of where the protests happen. Think of where all these major civil rights events are going to occur. It's happening here. So this is just a little preview, I feel like, of what is going to be quite inevitable, that these are the five states that are primarily going to be the nexus of this clash over this issue as we move into the next couple decades. And guess what? Democratic Party leaders of 1948, not only did Truman win the election, there were down ballot successes as well. The Democrats flipped the House and Senate. So not only did Truman's campaign strategy work for him, but going around calling the Republican Congress a do-nothing Congress worked really well for the Democrats as well. So it's a huge, huge victory when really his own party wasn't sure he could do it. And yet he's had this massive win. And I mean, and I will say 4.5 points in the popular vote is not a massive mandate. But when you can have that electoral college victory that you have that spans a number of states, when you can win the Congress along with the presidency, that shows some real juice, some real power.
The swing states of California, Ohio, and Illinois, Truman wins each state by less than a percentage point. So
those are the real swing states for sure.
Very narrow. So had Dewey won any of the two, had won any two of those three states, it would have thrown the election to the House. So it actually is a little bit more narrow in some places than in others.
What we're talking about when we say that is we're talking about basically 12,000 voters in California, Ohio, or Illinois. If 12,000 in two of those three states had voted for Dewey, this would have gone to the House. And I say this because I know it sounds trite, but voting matters. And even in the electoral college system, which can be frustrating and confusing, I think, for the average American voter, it still very much can matter. If 12,000 people in any one of those states had either not shown up or voted a different way, the entire course of this election would have shifted. And I will say props to Truman for even winning California by less than 1%, because that's where Earl Warren was from. The popular Republican governor who was the vice presidential candidate on the other ticket still managed to lose his state. And Dewey was really hoping, obviously, Warren's addition to the ticket was not just because he's great, but Dewey was really hoping to get California. And that seemed like they felt like a foregone conclusion. They felt confident they'd take California, but that was really a jewel of this particular win for Truman. But again, it is close. And in those places, I mean, 24,000 voters made the difference in two states. And that's just, I think, worth thinking about, reflecting on whenever you go to vote, is that, you know, sometimes just a few thousand voters can make a big difference.
Yep. Dewey is going to point to farmers. We talked about earlier. He said that he had won farmers in 1944 and had lost them in 1948, and that lost him the whole race. So Dewey points to the farm vote. Truman shows a lot of savviness in how he builds the coalition. That's a diverse enough coalition that has a big enough tent, as we say today, to include labor, Black voters, farmers, people with diverse interests that would not necessarily, you'd think, align. Truman finds a way to make it happen. He resurrects FDR's coalition and proves that it isn't just FDR, that the Democratic coalition can hold together without Franklin Roosevelt at the head. So for that reason alone, that's going to be a particularly important nugget for the Democrats moving forward, that the coalition can hold without the person at the top.
And yeah, I think in terms of sort of thinking about the impact of this election, obviously, it's a huge win for Truman to win this in his own right, to be able to then be president in his own right, to have won it himself is huge. There's a very famous photo of him holding up that Dewey defeats Truman newspaper. You get to kind of have that victory lap. But I think beyond just the impact on sort of Truman and the flipping of Congress, this is a big wake-up call in the world of political polling. In fact, the polling industry really makes a lot of changes following 1948. One of the big perceptions at that time was that most voters decided who they were going to support at the conventions. So once each convention nominated their nominee, you would then basically decide then. So you decide in the summer. And most polling firms felt that if you polled Americans at September 1st, it wouldn't be all that different the first Tuesday in November. I think we all know today that that's not really how humans work. That's not really how politics works. We have the old talked about these October surprises and things that can come up, right? These things that pop up last minute that can happen in elections. This is going to be the election where a lot of polling firms say, wait a second, voters aren't deciding in the summer. They're deciding maybe 2 weeks before, maybe 2 days before. Polling firms also started recognizing after this the importance role that the media would play and how these media narratives can shape polling perceptions. And so there's a massive overhaul. Gallup, in fact, makes major changes to how they poll after this 1948 election. And I think that this election really starts to become a moment where we see the mid-century ideas of each party, what makes a Democrat, what makes a Republican, start to shift a bit. There's definitely, I think, a moment here where we start to see that different voting blocks and groups are recognizing that these different parties might offer different things and at different times. We see a little shift of who considers himself a Democrat, who considers himself a Republican. And this will continue to shift as we move into the next few elections, right? On the next few presidents that come along, Eisenhower and Kennedy, for example. And again, what happens with the Dixiecrats here in this election is a harbinger of what is to come for the Democratic Party and for the country writ large. And it's just a story about how Truman is awesome.
Truman is awesome.
An underrated politician, truly a man of the people who like to get out there and just be face to face with them. And that's what he did best. And that's where he had the biggest success.
Yes, I think Truman gets a lot of props for being a good president, but not as much props for being a good politician. And I think he should get more because this is a masterful win for him. He just goes all in, puts all his chips in, and has nothing to lose and does it.
So that is our election of 1948. I think there are many lessons to be learned from this election. I don't know if anybody with any power listens to this podcast, but if you're anybody who knows anybody, I think there's many lessons to be learned from 1948.
I agree.
And even though it's only April, we'll encourage you all now, if you're not registered to vote, please register to vote. I'm not Taylor Swift, but if my little endorsement means anything to you, please register to vote. Know how to vote this year, yes, in presidential elections, but in any elections coming up in your state, your city, your county, your town. But if for some reason you're not, this is a great time to get registered.
Exactly. Check your registration status. It's pretty easy to do online. Thanks, everybody, for coming along with us. We will probably have another election-related episode before the election this year, because it's the only thing we can think about in an election year in Washington. And we are so excited for you to come along with us. We love talking about these. If there's an election that you're particularly interested in, we would love to put that on the calendar. And if there's any other topic, we want to talk about that too. And you can get in touch with us on all the socials at Tour Guide Tell All. We're tourguidetellall@gmail.com, and we're on Instagram and the Twitters and all that. And so feel free to get in touch. We love to hear from you. Come on a tour, and we will be back with more fun and goodness in a few weeks.
Thank you guys so much. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.